Sarva jive sarva sanste brihante tasmin hamso brahmyate brahmachakre pritagatmanam piritaram jamatva jushtastataste namitatvam eti.
The swan-like spirit soul wanders in the great wheel of Brahman, the giver of life to all, and the source to which all return. When the soul understands himself and his controller as distinct, he gains the Supreme's grace and thus achieves immortality. We had a few verses before, just before the sages collectively were meditating, and they had a vision, inarticulate vision of Brahman that they graphically saw as first as a great wheel and then as a river. They saw Brahman with his energies. Now, we're shifting to the real substance of the Upanishad. The one sage among them, Shvetashvatara, is speaking up, and he's giving his systematic realizations. He's now assuming the position of Acharya, and they're accepting him as authority, and he's speaking. So he's telling them, basically, gentlemen, please realize that you're all in Maya. We can sit here and speculate and meditate, but we're conditioned souls living in the material world, and we have to face the reality and deal with our real problems. So that's the relevance of the instructions of the Upanishad. It gets right to the core of the problems of material existence. Very concise, very, in a sense, very austere presentation of the bare essence of spiritual knowledge. Okay, so here, Shvetashvatara begins right off describing the predicament of the living entity in the material world. The jiva is called hamsa. That means swan, but there's a poetic explanation of the word too. It comes from the verb hun, which means to move. So the hamsa is the living entity who's wandering, moving aimlessly around the material universe. Of course, the Supreme Person is also called hamsa sometimes, so the word has different meanings. The living entity is also swan-like. He's also spiritual in essence. He's also perfect in his own way. And he's wandering, this word brahmyate. Of course, we should be familiar with this word if we know Bhagavad Gita. There is one verse, it's here in the book, you can look at it, first verse under the translation. Toward the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Ishvarak sarva bhutanam vidhe sher junatishtati. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities. Brahmayan sarva bhutani, he's making all the living entities wander. He's causing them to suffer and enjoy the reactions of their karmic activities. And he's the super soul. And this body, or the whole material existence, is like a machine. So that word yantra is there, and brahmyate is repeated both in this verse here in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, and it's in the Gita. Yes, Prabhu? That's from Chaitanya Charitamrita. Quoted in Nectar Devotion. Yes, that's in Bengali, Brahmite. And that's referring to both of these original sources. Krishnadas Kaviraj is drawing ancient sources, Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads. When he talks about the living entity wandering, this is where he gets his idea from. He's borrowing the image from both Bhagavad Gita and this and other Upanishads. So living entity is wandering. And he's wandering in this world which is called, again, Brahmachakra. We had this image in the vision of the sages of the great wheel of Brahman. So in itself, that vision doesn't change our lives. We don't get any real knowledge out of that. It's their own private mystic realization. But now Shvetashvatara Rishi is scientifically, philosophically describing this wheel of Brahman, what the significance really is. This is the material world that you're trying to enjoy and you're wandering in and suffering. This, in this verse, we're getting the answers to three of the basic questions asked in the first verse. The sage is asked, by what do we live? Jivamakena, what gives us our life? What do we return to after death, after annihilation of the universe? Where do we go back to? And what makes us suffer? Why are we forced to be unhappy in this life? All three questions are given some answer in this verse. Because the answer is Brahma. The wheel of samsara, the cycle of material existence, birth and death repeatedly, is created by Brahman to satisfy the desires of the rebellious living entities. That's described very concisely in the first half of this verse. The second half of the verse describes self-realization. Describes how a living entity in this predicament can can become saved and delivered from this predicament. And the idea given here, matva. Matva here means knowing. By understanding the truth, one becomes free. This is the basic theme of this Upanishad, repeated over and over again. From knowledge comes liberation. But the Upanishad also makes it very clear what this knowledge actually means, what kind of knowledge is meant, will be explained very thoroughly, gradually. And it's actually right here in the very first statement of the Rishi, he explains concisely, but he explains it all. Pritak atmanam priritaram jamatva. If you simply understand the difference between you, the spirit soul, and the Supreme Lord who is your controller, that knowledge will jushtas, will satisfy the Supreme, and he'll grant you liberation. Like Krishna says again in the Gita, janma karma cha me divyam. Anyone who understands, Krishna says, my transcendental birth and activities will not take birth again, but it'll come back to me. Basically the same idea, spoken by Krishna himself. When the soul understands himself and his controller as distinct, he gains the Supreme's grace and thus achieves immortality. This is a special kind of knowledge. Ordinary knowledge, just knowledge of material phenomena, knowledge of your own personality and psychology, this will not solve the problems of your material existence. Only this essential knowledge of the identity of the Supreme, of yourself, and the special relationship of the two of you as two distinct, separate entities. Only that kind of knowledge will give you liberation. And the implication is, knowledge leads to liberation. That implies how you got into your miserable condition was forgetfulness. Learning something means regaining knowledge that you forgot. Even in the Western world, beginning with the Greek philosophers, Plato, it's understood what education is. Education is not just filling up an empty vessel, pouring information into somebody, although some people have that idea. The more intelligent philosophers understand the real meaning of education. The Greek word, as Plato pointed out, edukare, means to draw something out of somebody. You know, just like squeezing toothpaste out of a toothpaste tube. Knowledge has to be squeezed out of the student. It's in him. It's in the heart. It just has to be... It's been covered over. It's been forgotten. Especially a spiritual knowledge of one's real identity. It has to be remembered. Ignorance, forgetfulness, caused our bondage. Knowledge will liberate us. Okay. I may move on to this next verse. Yes. It is very personal. The impersonalists manage to understand this in their own way, but they have to work very hard to squeeze an impersonal understanding out of these verses. And it gets more and more personal. If you look at them with any proper vision, the Upanishads are not impersonal. The impersonalists can use them for their own purposes, but they're not really impersonal. They're esoteric. And you have to understand the Upanishads with the guidance of a self-realized teacher. If you have the wrong teacher, you can think that you can get the impression that they're impersonal if you're given a twisted interpretation. Okay, we look at the next verse. Okay, this verse, number 6, we just read, describes the jiva, his predicament, and how he gets free from it. Now we focus our attention again on the Supreme Himself, on the Absolute Truth.
Udgitam etat paramam tu brahma tasmins trayam swapatishtaksharam cha atrantaram vedavido viditva lina brahmani tapara yoni mukta.
This absolute truth, glorified as Brahma, self-sufficient and inexhaustible, incorporates the three truths of existence. By realizing the distinction among these truths, knowers of the Vedas become merged in spirit with the Supreme. They become devotees of the Supreme and are freed from material birth. Okay, so in my translation, I made this sound devotional. I'll try to justify it, looking at the actual words. I don't think I'm cheating here. This Supreme Brahman, this Brahman is the Supreme Truth, Parama. And in that Brahman are found the three separate aspects of reality. They were mentioned already. Pidat atmanam predatanam tamatva, that's two of them at least. The soul and the impeller of the soul, the Supreme Person. And then nature is the third. The three aspects of reality that are contained in Brahman can be understood this way as God Himself, the Jiva and nature, or Rang Ramanuja, in the Sri Sampradaya gives another interpretation. He says it means the Jiva, nature, and time is the third. Either way is acceptable. This absolute truth is Swapatishta. He has no other foundation. Pratishtha means foundation. He's his own foundation. He is his own foundation. He's the basis of everything, and there's nothing beyond him. He has no other foundation. Anakshanam. Kshar means to deteriorate. He never changes, he never deteriorates. He's never exhausted. And Udgitam, this very first word, means that he's glorified. So that specifically means that he's described in the Upanishads. So we have the first basis of authority in the previous verse, where the sage, Shvetashvatara, begins speaking. From that point on, this Upanishad becomes seriously philosophical, and not just some mystic, inscrutable description of some mystic experience. It becomes understandable, it becomes philosophical from the point, the authority, self-realized, empowered authority, the sage who had the power to explain, started speaking. And now the second important basis of authority is introduced with this word Ugitam, which refers to the authority of the scriptures of the Upanishads. This absolute truth is described in the Upanishads. Rang Ramanuja Acharya, in his commentary, shows us... How the Supreme is glorified, or examples of the Supreme being glorified in these same ways in the Upanishads. Here he's called Swapratishtha. He's his own foundation. And that's in the Mahanarayan Upanishad. We find the statement, Narayanat param brahma swamahimni pratishtitaha. Narayan is the Supreme Absolute Truth. He is established on his own glory. And then the word akshara, meaning infallible, is in this verse. That's also, that quality of the Supreme is also glorified throughout the Upanishads. In Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the longest Upanishad. Etad, etad vai tad aksharam gargi brahmana abhivadanti. The great Brahmins, those with spiritual vision, they all glorify the infallible absolute truth. And in another Upanishad, the Mundaka Upanishad, that's the main theme, Akshara Brahma, the infallible absolute truth, inexhaustible absolute truth. Okay, I can't spend any more time on that point. Here, it becomes obvious, even now, it's only the second verse of the sage speaking, that the kind of self-realization he's talking about, if we can see clearly, it's obviously devotional service. Antaram Veda Vido Viditva, the knowers of the Vedas understand the difference between the Supreme Lord and his different energies. Lina Brahmani, they become merged in Brahman. So of course the impersonalists take this word lina, which means merged. And they take it in their own way. They think that the living entity loses his personal identity. But that contradicts what is right in the other statements in these two and three verses. It would be self-contradictory to, in one line, say that the essence of all knowledge is to know the difference between God, the living entity, and nature. And then the next line to say that when you understand that, then you merge into God, and there is no more distinction. It's all obliterated. That's contradictory. So, for all of this to be consistent, we have to take the word lina in a somewhat figurative sense, not literally merged, not obliterating your identity. This is a description of a devotional relationship, becoming merged in spirit or in desire with the Supreme. Mayarpita manobhuti, as Krishna says. The devotees, as they become more realized, their minds and intelligence become merged with mine. That is the only way we can consistently understand the word lina, or merged here. The knowers of the Vedas, their hearts become merged in Brahma. Tatpara, that means devoted. Para tatpara means devoted. Devoted to him, the Supreme. And yoni mukta. Thus, that is the process of liberation. Not some impersonal self-annihilation, but devotional service. Okay, any questions on that, on those two verses? No, it means to merge. It means that, I only want what Krishna wants. It means to merge my intelligence and mind with his, meaning that I have no other desires, no other plans, no other thoughts than Krishna's. That's merging. Merging, sharing your intentions and your desires with Krishna. When those who want what Krishna wants, they're devotees, and those who fight with Krishna, they're non-devotees. That is what is being said here. It's a devotional translation, but I'm trying to prove that it's there in the words. I'm not just cheating or forcing some interpretation on it. Okay, but the ancient acharyas also had that opinion, and they gave many good logical reasons. They examined the text word by word. They examined the logic and the syntax. They demonstrated in so many ways how this is the real meaning. Because unfortunately, we don't have the time. We could spend 6 months rather than 1 month dissecting this verse by verse and proving all these points. But I have to go quickly just to cover everything. Yes, Lena. Okay, I don't know the root. I can't recognize the verb. Lena? Well, probably not, because in Sanskrit, the literal meaning of li means to dissolve. In Russian, rastvoryat, to dissolve. It's a different idea. Okay, we'll jump to the next verse. Number 8. Samyuktam etat kshadam aksharam cha vyakta vyaktam bharate vishvam ishaha Anishas chatma bhajate bhoktri bhavaj gyatva devam uchyate sarva pashai. Okay. The Isha, the controller, the person who has all power and is capable. Isha means literally capable. The Lord who is capable of controlling everything. He maintains, Bharate. Bri means to carry or maintain. Like Bharta means husband. Britya means a servant who is the person who has to be maintained is called Britya. The Lord maintains Vishwam. Vishwam, we know this word Vishwa means universe. But another more literal meaning of the word is just everything. The universe is everything. So the word Vishwa means both universe and it means all or everything. So the Lord maintains everything. Vyakta avyakta. Kshara and akshara. Samyukta. Samyukta means combined. The combination of everything. Because in this world that we're living in, it's mixed up. It's not pure spirit, it's not pure matter. There's another world, the spiritual world. It's not mixed up. It's all spirit. Living entities are there, and other expansions of the spiritual energy are there, giving pleasure to the Lord. But in the material world, we have a combination of spirit and matter. Incoherent. It's like water and oil. They don't really combine properly. But that's the world we're dealing with. The combined world of kshara and akshara. The exhaustible and the inexhaustible. That means matter is exhaustible. It's always changing, it's always degenerating. And matter is vyakta, it's what we see in front of us. With our own ordinary eyes, it's all we see. We see material things. We think we're talking to other people, we're just looking at their dead bodies. And when I call the person's name, I'm just referring to the body because I don't see the soul, I don't know the soul. So the visible world is the world of dead matter. But that's mixed up with the spirit souls who are inhabiting this world, but they're invisible. So there's the visible, corruptible matter and the invisible, incorruptible souls. That's this world, the combination of both of them. There's another person, Isha, who maintains all of this. That's the statement in the first half of the verse. Then the living entity, his situation is again described. He's called Anisha, not the first time. The second time the living entity is called Anisha. That means he's not the controller. He's incapable of controlling even his own situation. Bhajyate. He is in bondage. He's trapped. He's not free. Bhoktra bhava, because he wants to be the enjoyer. This is why the living entity is suffering in this world. There may be some controversy sometimes about why we're in this world. You know, is it God's fault that we're here? Is it just his choice that some living entities are always in the material world and other, you know, and some are always in the spiritual world? Or do we come here? He's here. Because we want to enjoy, that's why we're bound up. It's our own fault, not God's. Living entity, God didn't force us to try to be separate enjoyers. We decided we wanted to do that. And therefore we were put into this brahmachakra, this material existence. That's our predicament. Then the fourth line, again, speaks the answer, or the solution. Gyatva devam muchyate sarvapashai. By knowing the effulgent, the transcendental personality of Godhead, and deva also means playful. So the Lord, who is enjoying his pleasure pastimes, by knowing him, you can join those pastimes. And then, thus, you obviously become free from all bondage by surrendering to the Supreme Lord and joining him in his spiritual pleasure pastimes. That's implied here, even by just by the word deva. Okay, okay, we're going to see a few references from the Vedanta Sutra here, in this and in verse 11. Don't worry, when you're reading the book and you come across verses that are quoted from Vedanta Sutra, don't worry about what they mean. I put them there for reference. They don't make much sense until they're explained. I have to read the commentary and explain it to you. But I put it there so when we're reading it, you can look in the book and see it. But when you're reading through your notes the night before, you don't have to pay too much attention to the Vedanta Sutra quotes. Okay, text number 9. Gya gyao dvava jav isha nishav ajahye ka boktra bogarta yukta anantas chatma vishvarupo hyakarta trayam yadavindate brahmam etat. There are two unborn persons, one all-knowing and all-powerful, the other ignorant and helpless. There is also one unborn female, exploited by the enjoying soul for his own pleasure. The supreme soul of the entire universe, however, never entangles himself in this way. When one understands these three, he attains the supreme. So here again is described three unborn, three eternal entities, who constitute the essence of all existence. That, of course, is the first one, the first unborn person, Aja, that form, Ajao, is the masculine dual. That means two males. The Supreme Lord and the living entity, they are considered Purushas, male. And Prakriti, or material nature, is considered female, Aja, that's the feminine form. All three of them are eternal. God, the living entity, and nature. But of the two males, one of them is all-knowing, the other one is ignorant. One is the Isha, the controller, and the other is helpless, out of control. Or he doesn't have control. The third one is the object of enjoyment by the living entity. Living entity is trying to exploit material nature and enjoy her. But we have to understand, as described in the second half of the verse, the unlimited soul, the Supreme Lord, he's the soul of the whole universe. He controls everything, including the deluding force of nature. He's not entangled the way the living entity is. He's called Akarta. He's not trying to exploit nature. If you understand him in his aspects, if you understand all three aspects of the truth, then you attain the Supreme. So this may seem repetitive. This has already been stated in each verse. The same ideas are being repeated. Someone may not dislike this kind of presentation as unnecessarily repetitive. The point is made. Why make it over and over again? Because this is what we have to understand. This may be boring to us. We may want to hear something more interesting, something new in each verse. But the point is, by understanding this, we become free from our material entanglement, and we can enter the spiritual realm where there is real variety, real enjoyment. Better to be bored now with our sadhana, learn our lesson, and get out of this world. Now, in the Vedanta Sutra, yesterday we read one passage from the Vedanta Sutra from the Govinda Bhasha of Baladeva Dibhushan. Well, the earlier Vedanta Sutra commentary, the first Vaishnava Vedanta Sutra commentary that still exists, was written by Ramanujacharya in the 11th century, almost 1,000 years ago. And he wrote a condensed version, an abridgment of his Vedanta Sutra commentary called Vedanta Deepa, a very short explanation of Vedanta. There in the second chapter, in his comments on the second chapter, first part, verse 35 of Vedanta Sutra, Ramanujacharya explains the one sutra, which reads, and you can see it here in your text, if there was some light, you could see it. Na karmavi bhagad iti chain na nadi twad upapajyate chap upalabhyate cha. That's the sutra. Translation of it, and I have to follow the commentary. I have to take the translation from the commentary. Without the help of a commentary, you usually can't even translate or understand what the sutras mean. But filling in a few words with the help of the commentary, the sutra means, if it is denied that karma explains the apparent unfairness of the Supreme, because there is no differentiation, that is disproven by beginninglessness, which is logical and is also seen in Scripture. Let me explain that. Someone's objecting that supreme seems to be unfair because someone's enjoying another person's suffering. And it's not always apparent that there's any reason why one person is enjoying another person's suffering. Sometimes it seems to be unfair. One will say the answer is supposedly that karma explains, the law of karma explains why one person suffers and another does not, and it's not God's fault. But then, the objector again comes back and says, well, karma is an impersonal law. It just works mechanically. Why does one person have good karma and another person not? There's no reason for people to have different karma. The law of karma works the same for everybody. Why does one person, completely entangled in sinful karma? Why is he a demon and another person a devotee? It still seems to leave the blame on God. So it's not that everybody's karma starts from the same point. It goes back as far back as you want to trace it. That is a logical reason, and also that is what is stated in Scripture. And in the commentary, Vedanta Deep, Ramanujacharya points out, yes, the Scriptures do say that the condition of the living entity in this world is eternal. Eternal from our point of view. We can't see the beginning of it. And he quotes this very verse from the Shvetashvara Upanishad. Gya gyao dvav ajav isha nishav. There are two living entities who are eternal, God and the soul. And one of them is all-knowing, the other one is ignorant and helpless. And he's eternally like that. So that Vedanta Sutra is using this verse to prove or to justify on a scriptural basis the idea that the living entity's karma has no traceable beginning in time. Okay, I'll go on to verse 10. Question, please. Yeah. Because that eternality is relative. It's eternal from the material point of view. But he was originally situated in that Satchidananda. He was enjoying with the Supreme Person, originally. But that was outside the scope of material time. The event of his falling down can't be measured in material time, that's all. So we're talking from the scope of time and space as we know it, but that's all material. Okay. Even the great sages who know better can only use the same language we know, and they have to describe things in terms that we understand, which are limited and relative. Okay? We don't have time to settle that question. Yeah. Yes? Yes. Bhokta Bhavat, it doesn't say because he's actually, the living entity is suffering, is budgete Bhokta Bhavat, what was said in the previous verse. It doesn't say because he is the enjoyer, because he's imagining himself to be the enjoyer. Bhava means mentality. He's thinking himself enjoyer. He's trying to be the enjoyer. That doesn't mean he can really do it. Trying to enjoy, trying to gain control and freedom, you get the opposite result. You get entangled and you suffer. So you can't be the real enjoyer. Yes? The living entity is also prakriti. He's also actually female in this philosophical sense that he's meant to be enjoyed. But he has the potential to try to be the enjoyer. He takes on that false role. Prabhupada describes that actually everyone in this world is female. And all the attempts to be a male and enjoy some male-female relationship as a male, that's all homosexual. Because actually everyone in the world, all the living entities are actually female.
Well,
Right, but you see, the description doesn't take that into account. It's a description of the mechanics. You know, it's the argument is being given that karma is the reason of our one person suffering and the other, not individual desire is not being brought into the issue. Individual desire can be understood when you trace karma back to its beginning. Why you have any karma at all is because of your individual desire. You jumped into this material world, and your karma started. But just looking at the mechanism of it, just like the scientists look at phenomena of life mechanically. So this is a sort of mechanical analysis of a particular living entity, not considering his desire. Okay. I'm not satisfied with this either. Why don't you give me till tomorrow a better answer to this? Okay, I'll go back and look at the commentary again. Okay, but we'll move on now. We have to read three more verses in 15 minutes. Kshadam pradanam amitakshadam haraha kshadatmana vishate deva ekaha tasya vijyanad yojanad tatva bhavad bhuyas chante vishvamaya nivrittihi. Material nature is fallible, and the living entity called hara is immortal and infallible. That effulgent Lord, the effulgent Lord alone, controls both his fallible subordinates, infallible subordinates. Wait a minute. Fallible. Yeah, I wrote it. Both his fallible subordinates. One who begins cultivating consciousness of him progresses to constant meditation on him, and then direct realization of him will in the end be free from material illusion. Which we want to scratch out? No, he controls two different fallible subordinates, the living entity and nature. Okay, one point of confusion, but this is what I got from the commentary of Rangwa Manuja. The living entity in one mind is called infallible, next mind is called fallible. Yeah. But that makes sense, because the living entity in his essence is perfect. He's pure spirit. He doesn't actually fall down. He doesn't actually become illusioned, or he doesn't actually lose contact with the Supreme, but he thinks he has. So he's both fallible and infallible, living entity. You know, he doesn't. Krishna is still there. He's forgotten Krishna, but Krishna hasn't forgotten him, and he's still a pure spirit soul. But he thinks he's this body, and he thinks he's the enjoyer and the controller, and that's his fallibility. Okay. Basic point in the first part again is that the effulgent Lord, the personality of Godhead, alone, ekaha, controls, ishate, both nature and the living entities. Material nature is fallible, it's flexible, it's mutable. Living entity is an eternal spiritual entity. He actually does not change. But in contact with material nature, he seems to change. So, according to Rangwa Manuja, this is answering a doubt. The second part of the verse describing three steps of the process of self-realization. Abhidhyana, Yojana, and Tattva Bhava, which are understood to mean the preliminary process of collecting your thoughts, of directing your attention to the Supreme. And then yojana, which is the same as yoga. Or either it can be understood either as deep meditation, deep concentration, or else practical service. It's like we understand yoga to mean bhakti yoga, devotional service. Not just thinking, but acting also. To understand theoretically your relationship with the Supreme is one thing. To begin to act practically in service of the Supreme, that's a higher realization. That's deeper. And the third stage is what's called prayojana, or the ultimate realization, the perfection of devotional service, which is here called tattva bhava, factual realization. what that factual realization is, what the goal to be achieved is clarified in the next two verses. So, according to Rang Ramanujacharya, this verse serves a special purpose of answering a doubt. Someone may doubt. You're saying, first of all, the sage says, by knowledge, one becomes liberated. So it seems to say that only knowledge is needed. So here, in answer to that doubt, whether someone actually asked it or whether he's just anticipating that someone may ask this question, Sri Tathagatara is pointing out what this knowledge actually involves, what the process involves. There are three stages. One is theoretical understanding. The other is practical realization, which at least in the sadhana that we follow, bhakti yoga, that involves practical service. Or in the meditational yoga, that means samadhi, complete concentration of attention. And then tattva-bhava, factual realization. Pratyakshavagamam, coming in direct personal contact with the Supreme. That is what's involved in real knowledge, not just some theoretical acquiring of information. And thus, according to the statement here, the mukti that was mentioned in the previous verse, mucchate sarvapashay, one is freed from all bondage. But what does that mukti consist of? Vishramaya nivritti, freedom from all illusion. And, as described here, meditation on the Supreme, intense concentration and practical service, realization of the Supreme directly, this liberation involves experience, direct personal experience of the Supreme. Okay, it's not just negative. Okay, 11th verse. Gyatva devam sarva pashapahanihi kshinai kleshaya janma mityu pahanihi tasyabhidyanad trityam deha vede vishvaishwaryam tevala aptakamaha. When one realizes the Supreme Lord, all his entanglement is dissolved. When one's troubles have thus become diminished to nil, one becomes no longer subject to birth and death. Then, at the third stage of advancement, reached by God-conscious meditation, one achieves his own unique spiritual body and is elevated to glory unequaled by anything in this world. Having given up attachment to matter, one enjoys the fulfillment of all desires. Okay. We have to justify that. This translation is actually there in the words, but it is. But we don't have much time. This is actually a description of perfection of devotional service, realization of one's spiritual body as a personal associate of the Supreme Person. Deha-bhede, when one's material body is dissolved, one attains Vishvaishwarya, ultimate opulence, kevala, separate from men, aptakama, with the fulfillment of all desires. Deha-bhede can mean two things. It can mean the breaking. Bhede can mean to break. So it can mean when your material body is dissolved. Or bhede means different. So it can mean you get a special body, a different kind of body. In a special kind of body, you attain your perfection, in a spiritual body. Okay. Now here, because this is also the opinion of Rang Ramanujacharya. It's not just our own sectarian point of view. Rang Ramanujacharya, who was a very conservative author, he was a strict Vaishnava, but he tried to explain things philosophically and not dogmatically. But his opinion is, Rang Ramanujacharya, following Ramanujacharya, says that Vishvaishwarya means the attainment of a body that is shuddha-sattva, purely spiritual. Because it's tritiyam, this is your third bodily existence. In this world we have a gross body and a subtle body, but you get a third kind of body when you attain spiritual perfection. That is your spiritual body. The word tritiya is there, describing the third body. Okay. Now here, to run through it quickly. is another use of this Upanishad by the Vedanta Sutra. From the Govinda Bhasha, Baladev Vidyabhushan. Commenting on the third chapter of the Vedanta Sutra, which describes sadhana, process of method of practice. In the third part of the third chapter verse, or sutra number 27. First of all, Baladev Vidyabhushan says that the sages who follow the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, they recite this verse, and he reads this verse. Gatva devam Gatva devam aptakama. Okay, this verse. You have the same verse we're reading here. When one realizes the Supreme Lord, all his entanglement is dissolved. When one's troubles have become thus diminished to nil, one becomes no longer subject to birth and death. Then as the third stage of achievement reached by God conscious meditation, one achieves his own unique spiritual body and is elevated to glory unequaled by anything in this world. Having given up attachment to matter, one enjoys the fulfillment of all desires. So Baladev Vidyabhushan quotes that verse and he goes on explaining it in his commentary on Vedanta Sutra. So in this verse it's described, he says, that by knowledge of the Supreme Person, one experiences the dissolution of the bondage of his life, the knots of selfish attachment to body, home, and so on. And then, subsequently, when these are dissolved, the more basic attachments of birth and death, which are the basis of his suffering, will also dissolve. This is a description of the glories of knowing the Supreme Lord as explained in the scriptures. So by studying the Upanishads, one can get the knowledge that leads to this kind of liberation and the success of life. Then when you know the true nature of the self and of the Lord, then you can engage in meditation on the Supreme Person, Krishna consciousness. And then by constant thought of the Supreme, one's subtle body is dissolved, and one achieves the third transcendental position, which is beyond, Baladev Vidyabhushan says, the two material situations that are achieved, two material successes of going to the moon planet or going to the planet of Brahma. One level of material success is to attain the moon planet. A higher level, achieved by great sages, is to go to the planet of Brahma. But the third level of success is to lose your subtle body, attain your spiritual nature, and go to the spiritual world. What is that transcendental state like, may be asked. That's answered. Vishvaishwaryam. That means it's full with all opulences. All possible opulences are available in one's spiritual existence. Kevalam, it means exclusive, it means untouched by any contamination of Maya. And thus one becomes full, you know, and all his desires are fulfilled. This describes, according to Baladev Vidyabhushan, how real knowledge, factual knowledge of the Supreme Person can be obtained by study of the scriptures, especially of the Upanishads. Okay, now there's a doubt. Vedanta Sutra always is concerned with resolving doubts about what the Upanishads are saying. So, taking this verse, now someone raises a doubt based on this verse. Well, this meditation on the Lord, is it required? Is it something, is it something regulated? Is it some other ritual, like the rituals in the Vedas? Is it strictly regulated, step by step, how you meditate on the Supreme? Is it an obligatory ritual? Or is it something more free and spontaneous? That's the doubt. Then someone may say, well, since it's very important to meditate on the Supreme Person, to think about him, in order to fortify, in order to establish one's firm understanding and faith, it must be regulated. It's an obligatory activity. It can't be just done whimsically. So someone says, no, it's a regulated ritualistic activity. In answer to that doubt, and to the claim that one must think about the Lord in a very regulated, ritualistic way. The sutra says, Hanau tu payana shabda sheshatva kusha chanda stut yubagana vantad uktam. Translation of that. When illusion has been destroyed, one's meditation on the Supreme is described as being like spreading kusha grass and chanting extra mantras by one's own choice. This is because all other statements are subordinate to the descriptions of devotional service. This means that, Bala David Bhushan explains this. So here, the other side's argument that one's meditation on the Supreme Person must be very regulated and carried out as an obligatory ritualistic activity, that's answered here. It's stated that when one has become freed from his attachments and his contamination by God realization, Devagyana, then one, such a wise person, becomes actually attached. He becomes attracted to the Supreme Person. He develops spiritual emotions. So even though this process of meditating on the Lord is described in the scriptures, it's not a ritualistic obligatory activity. It becomes spontaneous when one has become freed from material attachment and contamination. Then his meditation on the Supreme becomes a spontaneous, natural function. It's not a mere ritual. It's not strictly regulated. As Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says about the process of Sankirtana, smaranena kala. No, there are no hard and fast rules about how to remember Krishna and his name. And so the analogy, the metaphor that's given is just like a Vedic student or a Vedic Brahmin. Every day he has to perform certain rituals that are prescribed. He has to perform in the morning and evening. He has to perform twice a day, every day, the Agnihotra sacrifice, offering milk to fire god in the morning and to Soma and the moon god in the evening. I think that way. Every day he has to perform the sacrifice. And twice a month he has to perform a more elaborate sacrifice called Darsha Purnamas. These are obligatory activities. But every day after he's done his obligatory rituals, he's free, if he wants to sit down, spread some kusha grass on the ground, sprinkle, do some achaman, and chant some prayers in glorification of the Supreme. That's his freedom. So like that, a pure devotee's meditation on the Supreme is a spontaneous, natural activity. It's not obligatory, it's not regulated. Okay, we'll leave verse 12 for tomorrow. Any questions at this point?